If you found this podcast, chances are you're a high achiever and you're successful. But now you're stuck and stressed, and you realize that everything you've created hasn't given you the fulfillment and the joy you thought it would. This is where we discuss the keys of high performance mindset and stepping into the next best version of yourself. Welcome to the Positive Persistence Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Positive Persistence Podcast, where we bring you stories to inspire you and strategies to help you tap into your potential and become your best self. Today, we are joined by an amazing entrepreneur. He is the CEO of the Pickle Juice Company, maker of Pickle Juice, the only scientifically proven beverage to stop muscle cramps. Now, with a background spanning sales, operations, and consumer storytelling, he's helped transform pickle juice from a niche remedy into a globally recognized performance product used by elite athletes. Drawing on his experience both on the rugby pitch and in the boardroom, he brings a unique blend of strategic thinking and real-world grit to building breakthrough brands. Philip Cupins, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here. I'll try to live up to that intro.
Well, I mean, it shouldn't be hard because that's all you. That is all you. So just a little background for our listeners and viewers. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Philip in Belize probably about 2 years ago by now, I think. And we were on a boat ride and we kind of got to talking and wow, this guy is amazing. And then found out that he was a CEO of Pickle Juice. Now, for those of us who may not have heard about Pickle Juice, Philip, can you tell us what the brand is and what it does?
Sure. We see our brand more like a hyper-functional product development company. Pickle Juice is our flagship product. We're starting to develop other products in our lab, but effectively what we're trying to do is prove that you can create organic, natural food-rated products that make real and acute differences. So our flagship product, Pickle Juice, actually has nothing to do with pickles or pickle brine. We call it that because we developed a proprietary grain of acetic acid that blocks the nerve receptors that cause the signals that cause muscle cramping. So it's the only product in the world that stops cramps, and it does it in about 60 seconds. So we're now exploring vasodilation remedies. We're looking at VO2 max improvement and various other things. We're experimenting with ketones and stuff like that. So the long and the short of it is that we are trying to carve out what we call the hyper-functional beverage space, creating products that can make a real difference acutely, immediately, and naturally.
So is this product, as you're talking, I'm thinking about like all of the different applications of this product. Is it currently just focused on athletes and performance, or are you guys branching out into other segments as well?
Yeah, athletes are kind of what we call our credibility play. And it's very aspirational, right? The July 4th this year, for instance, the Texas Rangers were playing the Padres in baseball on ESPN, and the Rangers pitcher was starting to have muscle cramps. So he was drinking our product on the mound on live TV. And ironically, the Padres also had it in their dugout, and the ESPN showed that as well. So what we want to do is create consumer confidence because we're introducing something they've never seen or heard of before. This is a completely different approach. So not only do you have to develop confidence in your product, but you have to develop confidence in the concept and also in who you are as an organization. Because if you're going to make such dramatic claims about a thing that you're giving to people, particularly one that's intended to be ingested, you better be super transparent about what you're doing. And not only about how you behave, but how you're acting, what you're making, how you're making it, and all of those things. So not only do we try to produce revolutionary products, we try to do it in a way that is responsible, transparent, and forward-thinking.
Right. Okay. Now, I know that your background spans sales, operations. I know that you are also into rugby. Right. And now you're leading a science-backed wellness brand. Now, how does this mix of your background, I was hoping to kind of unpack your background a little bit, but how does that mix really shape your mindset when you were faced with any early business challenges that you had building this brand or just really stepping into your own as Philip Coupens, as you went from an adolescent to a young adult to where you find yourself now?
It was interesting because I've sort of, my history is that I've always been very, very successful with an organization and then immediately sort of find myself on the outside. And this was like with big Fortune 500 type companies. And even in the military, I experienced that to some degree because I always sort of had a different way of viewing things, which was centralized around how we interact with the space around us. And it's looking at it from the perspective of the environment rather than our own needs. And that sort of translated in a way that didn't really resonate with the leadership I was around in many cases, because they, I remember one time I had I'll call him a boss, that said to me, and I was working for a large CPG company, and he said, there's the right way, the wrong way, and the company's way. You have to do everything the company's way. And I asked him, and not to be snarky, I was being genuine, and I said, why wouldn't we want to do it the right way? Why wouldn't we want to pursue the right way? And this sort of innate curiosity and desire to just do what's right rather than do what is conventional. And I don't have the ability to not speak truth to power. And sometimes that can get misconstrued. So I think early in my career, people might have perceived me to have a problem with authority, although I would argue that it didn't. And in the military, when I was sort of coming up as your standard run-of-the-mill soldier, I was kind of that guy that was sort of a source of frustration, I suppose to my leadership. And then I found myself in like a special warfare type of environment, sort of special services type of stuff. And in that space, it was not resisted. It seemed to work really well. So I think a lot of us who dare to think outside of convention will often receive pushback because it diverts from the norm, and right, wrong, or indifferent, people are resistant to change. And I think that is kind of a recurring theme that I've had to train myself to be more empathetic to the comfort of the status quo to the people that I'm dealing with. I've had to teach myself to kind of be more empathetic to that viewpoint and recognizing the fact that while people inherently want to seek the truth in the most optimized, efficient way to do things and the right way to do things, there's a component of risk aversion that many people have to compete with. And it's, sure, not everybody is comfortable being uncomfortable. And I think those of us who competed in sports or found ourselves in high pressure environments in the military, that's a lot more normalized to us than I think what we recognize is the norm.
Both of those instances, whether, you know, you're in the military or in the business world, corporate situation where you're in those high pressure scenarios and you find yourself up against adversity, what are some of the things that, or maybe some of the habits you have or some of the frameworks that you use to be able to maximize your own efficiency in those types of situations? Not to be either paralyzed by the situation, but being able to pull yourself together and move yourself forward through that adversity.
A thing that's helped me a lot has been focusing on the what, not the who, and to focus on seeking resolution rather than associating a problem with a person or even allowing that person to believe that they're the problem. The reality is it doesn't matter what that vessel of delivery of any challenge or problem is. In the moment, it's about the problem. And I think we tend to get very emotional when something challenging occurs and we get hung up on that emotion, and we in turn it's human nature to react emotionally to that. So having taught myself to focus on the what, not the who, and sometimes reminding people that we're focusing on the what, not the who, and giving people the room to fail, allowing people, I tell people all the time, I said, look, I don't care if you fail. If the pathway to that decision tracks and you don't cost the company a bunch of money or create a PR nightmare or make the same mistake over and over, it's a great opportunity to learn something. But you have to genuinely believe that. You have to give people the confidence and the faith to do their job and recognize that the path that people take to get somewhere isn't always going to be the same path you take, but you have to accept the result. Is the result acceptable? And is the pathway acceptable, whether or not it's exactly how you would have done it? So I think I would answer the question by saying, removing my emotions and myself from scenarios and looking at the scenario exactly for what it is, like an algorithmic problem rather than an emotional problem. And that is also a lot more difficult to do than one would think.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And because I was going to ask you as a follow-up question of that, how do you, I guess, for lack of a better term, placate your emotions, your nervous system that is firing, that has gotten you emotional about the situation? Maybe you're doubting yourself and you're nervous and you have anxiety. How do you remove that from the situation so you can just focus on the problem itself and solving it?
I operate it very well when I understand things and understand the logic beyond things and sort of the science beyond things, right? Fundamentally, I'm driven by science and logic and stuff. So what I look at it is evolutionary patterns of management of behavior, of efficiencies. And what's interesting is if you notice now in elite level team sports, at halftime, almost every single team will start their sort of adjustment period and conversation with calming exercises. And these are now formalized calming exercises. Like you'll see teams huddle up and go through a box breathing exercise before anybody talks about anything. You also notice that very rarely do you see elite sports, and I'm going to say this sort of outside of the spectacle piece of it, but when an athlete is truly preparing to perform at his or her best, it's no longer about hyping a person up. It's actually about calming the mind. And this has been a big shift in sports, in management, and everything about allowing a person to operate in their most efficient cerebral space possible. And for me, that works is creating that understanding and building around that, going through physical exercises, like taking a few seconds to like go through a box breathing exercise, like taking a second to sort of literally decompress or doing whatever it is, and knowing when I have the mental capacity to deal with the situation or not, and then having the discipline to not. And it requires you to believe that even with yourself, it's about the what, not the who. Therefore, if we're being honest about that, we also shouldn't allow our emotions to be elevated. Because if we respond emotionally, we can almost guarantee that the response is not going to be as well as if we don't. So even if it's something that affects us personally and directly, allowing our anger, our emotions to drive our response will almost always guarantee a less desired outcome. And that works for me. It is knowing that I'm driven by achieving the best desired outcome. And, you know, we're humans. We don't always get it right. But that focus in creating a space that has the highest probability of a positive outcome is the motivating tool that works for me.
So it sounds like what you're saying is in order to achieve that, that best positive outcome, you're not really making yourself devoid of emotions. You're really regulating your nervous system so you can calm those emotions, get into the quote unquote right headspace so you can make the right decision.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's wild too, right? It's again, using more sports analogies, when you see an athlete's ego drive his or her decisions is when they fail. A boxer that diverts from their strategy to go toe-to-toe with an opponent who wants to go toe-to-toe with them. This is why people try to like get in your head or do all these things, because they know innately that if they can get you off your game, which means respond emotionally, you're going to be at a disadvantage. So if we apply that logic to business and life, the same thing applies. It just presents itself in much more subtle ways. Therefore, we sort of don't even recognize when it's happening. So it's really just applying that, going, okay, what's my desire here? Is it to placate my ego? Well, if that's the case, I need to fix that. I need to fix that need, because if I'm trying to placate my ego, I'm not going to achieve the best results. I'm not even going to achieve the best results for my ego, because the outcome will be compromised. So if I'm really being driven by self-validation or external validation, I'm not going to get that, because I've achieved a compromised outcome anyway. So it becomes a conflicting interest. So why bother? You know, it's a waste of energy.
That's interesting, because going back to what you were talking about before in terms of like your comfort zone, I think that most of us, we don't want to have a bruised ego, right? So we stay in that comfort zone. So we don't step outside of that, as for fear of either failure or fear of not being accepted or fear of being judged. And that keeps us locked in to not achieving our best self. How would you, and I know that, I mean, you already kind of touched on this, but how do you get somebody to believe in themselves? And I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I have to imagine, as you were growing this company, you've had your hurdles and your struggles, and you've had to rally your troops. And as a sidebar, quickly, what are some of your main competitors? I know that you're carving out a niche for yourself, but what were some of your main competitors as you were growing Pickle Juice and trying to get it to be more mainstream?
I think what we face is more like perceived competition rather than actual competition, which is arguably more threatening, because it could dilute what people think your brand is. So there are a few pickle companies out there that are now packaging brine and trying to market it as pickle juice. So they have less efficacy, a different profile, a different approach. They don't have the clinical trials and testing that we have. And what happens is that somebody may use that product, not experience the results that we claim we can deliver. And then now they're telling their peer group, hey, this stuff doesn't work. And it's interesting, because it's only in the US domestic market where pickles are a thing, right? You go into a Walmart and you see like 16 feet of pickles, which wild if you really think about it, right?
Yeah.
But I really love pickles. So we spend more time educating the consumer on differentiating it, and and it's challenging, because we want to be honest, accommodating, transparent, but sometimes you have to protect your brand, and you have to do
right
by getting lawyers engaged and things like that, and unfortunately, you know, at times you have to meet competition on their terms, and unfortunately some people don't necessarily operate in a way that reflects the values that we're trying to project onto the marketplace.
As you're growing and you're running into some of the setbacks, how do you, I guess, get your team in the right mindset to you know, going to battle every day? Because I imagine this is an uphill climb for you guys as you are growing and continuing to expand.
Yeah, it's challenging, and it's something that I'm personally very conscious of trying to push people outside of their comfort zone to achieve what they're capable of achieving, or what I feel they're capable of achieving through holding themselves to a higher standard without making them feel like I'm riding them or coming down on them. And finding that balance can be really, really challenging. Also finding the balance of identifying somebody that just doesn't want to come along for the ride, and identifying that person early enough and having a flat and transparent organization it's a great way to operate, but it's also very, very fragile and requires that all the other leaders within the org hold themselves to the same high standard and hold their teams to the same high standard. Mm-hmm. Because if somebody that's not bought in, or somebody that doesn't want to row in the same direction, if you will, isn't identified and removed quickly enough, they can be a real, real negative influence on everything around them. And that analogy of, you know, one bad grape can ruin the batch and all of these things, and a disruptive individual can disrupt a group is really true. I actually read recently about some study that was conducted at some university in Australia a while back, where a professor was creating these groups and these group assignments, and would deliberately introduce an actor, if you will, in each group whose role was to be disruptive, but in a different way, like either be apathetic or sarcastic or non-participatory or something like that. And they found that one disruptive person would reduce the efficiency of a team by 40-60%, because the team spends more time dealing with that person and the energy that that person is projecting,
sure,
than they are the task. And if you also look at some European business models, and you look at like some French companies who've adopted like a 30-hour work week that produce the same output as a company with like a 50-hour work week, and we can't figure out how that happens, but it's because we're applying our values and systems rather than their values and systems. And inherently, they are coached and conditioned to think about the organizational results rather than the individual results. Mm-hmm. And the individual results come along with the organizational results. And that proves again that if we can get everybody rowing in the same direction, really believing and being part of that, and being recognized and rewarded for their contribution towards the ultimate goal, where they don't have to worry about themselves, that you're going to achieve great things.
It's time to ask yourself, when was the last time you prioritized you? Did you know that research shows that nearly 85% of high performers struggle to maintain a performance mindset while juggling the demands of work and personal life? Those who actively prioritize their performance mindset and personal growth are 30% more likely to achieve their goals in business and life. If you're feeling crippling stress and anxiety, or if you're feeling guilty when you take a moment for yourself, or if you're stuck in the grind and feeling burnt out, you're not alone. Many of us yearn for more, but struggle with the fear of being judged or feeling selfish, and you want to step into the next best version of yourself. That's why I created the Rinse Method, which got me from paraplegic to marathon runner. Backed by science-based proven strategies and now customized for high performers like you. If you're stuck and stressed and want clear steps that you can implement today to move forward, make sure you visit thepositivepersistence.com to download our free Rinse PDF.
Right. And clearly you guys you're doing that as you continue to grow the company. And I couldn't help but think when you were talking about that one, you know, bad grapes spoils the bunch, and thinking about how that correlated to the study you were talking about when you have that bad apple or that bad grape, that really takes other people's attention away from what they're supposed to be doing. and drawing that comparison to our personal lives in terms of who we are with. And they always say, you know, you're the culmination of the five people that you hang out with. It really highlights the point that in order for you to be able to step into the next best version of yourself, or to take that next step, or to level up, that you need to be surrounding yourselves with the right type of people. And if you find yourself having your attention put on somebody who's negative or is not there to help you push yourself in the right direction, then you're really spinning your wheels and you're not doing yourself any service.
Yeah. I struggled with that for a long time myself. I had a lot of like personal insecurities and self-doubt, and I found myself being so desperate for approval of people that I was finding myself surrounded by people that weren't the healthiest people to have around me, because they would give me that very superficial validation, and I would ignore the fact that I was being taken advantage of and sort of being ridiculed and beat down and stuff. And it wasn't until fairly recently that I learned to cut people like that out of my life. And what you're saying is exactly right. It's having the discipline and sort of the self-respect, if you will, to not allow people that are self-serving, narcissistic, or generally toxic, mm-hmm. to be in that circle and to live in a space where you're giving and receiving equally, and also not being that person, right? And things have changed so dramatically since I changed that perspective. And what's interesting too is I find myself behaving in a healthier way. I find myself choosing to do different things socially than I would have otherwise, mm-hmm. and things that are more rewarding, and whether it be in the moment or in the long term. And it just creates a more joyful existence, frankly.
I love that. Yeah, so true. I mean, when you, again, putting yourself in that right mindset or that right situation that's fertile for your growth, then you start to see amazing things happen for you. And I'm curious, because you said this has happened relatively recently. What are some of the, maybe the habits or the routines that you do on a daily basis to kind of keep yourself in that good headspace and those good routines or habits?
I always try to give. I always try to be involved in things outside of work. So I volunteer, coach, and volunteer minister in the rugby space. I feel it that my ability to give back to the game that gave so much to me is very fulfilling. I also feel like it makes an actual difference. I also believe in learning outside of work. So I'm always trying to like learn new skills and abilities and introduce new passions to people. That just, I gain joy out of seeing joy in others, and I also gain joy in like learning new things. I think when we met, I was talking about trying to learn how to sail. I'm still trying to learn how to sail, but it's things like that where we can challenge ourselves beyond what we do for a living. It's really, really rewarding. And it sounds a bit cliche, but I realized what I used to do was mask my actual needs through like short dopamine type of things, like through participating in sports. Well, as we get older, we can't do that anymore, right? So right. I had this like outlet, but what I didn't realize is that outlet was more of a mask than it was a true delivery mechanism, I guess, of a better space, where it was kind of like, you know, I was going to practice every Tuesday, Thursday, playing on Saturdays and doing all of the workout stuff in between to be able to do that as well as I could. And what I didn't realize is that those were short cycle things, sort of treating symptoms, if you will, rather than really understanding the bigger thing. And once that was gone, I felt that there's like, well, what's happening? I'm kind of like depressed or like not feeling as whole. And I thought it was because I was missing the game, but what I what I didn't realize is that was always there. I was just masking it through activity and recognizing that and treating the cause rather than the symptoms is what's allowed me to get into this more kind of a whole space, if you will.
That is really interesting. So what I'm hearing you say is that the energy that you were putting into training and practice and participating in your games was something that you purposely kept in your life because it kept you really focusing on that instead of focusing on the thing that you, well, maybe consciously or subconsciously knew that you needed to work on.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'd definitely say it was subconscious because I think it was, I certainly didn't know at the time. And
yeah.
And now if you look at it and you hear people talk about that too, like, I need to go like run out my aggression or go to the gym and work out my frustration. Well, when you really think about that, what are they really doing? They're treating that symptom. They're not saying, well, why do you feel aggression?
Right.
Why do you feel aggression? Why do you feel frustration? Right. Why are you allowing yourself to respond? Because like feeling aggression and frustration is something you fundamentally control. It's an emotional response to something. It isn't a thing that's put upon you. Right. And we talked about that on the outset. It's about how we respond to things.
Right.
That is so critical that we don't even recognize some things are a response because we're so, we find ways to treat, to I guess suppress it without addressing it. And I didn't recognize that's what I was doing through sport since I was in high school. And I've always been involved in pretty competitive sports, whether it be skiing or even going back to junior high. I was a skateboarder in addition to running track and doing what everybody else does through high school. And then I got into competitive skiing and rugby and all this stuff. So I always had this thing that was treating the symptoms. And when that thing wasn't there, I just didn't feel right. And I thought I missed the game. Well, it wasn't the game I was missing. It was the fact that I never had to treat the underlying thing that required me to have that outlet. And then, you know, when you get to be a certain age, you can't really go out and do those things anymore because you get hurt.
Right.
You get caught.
Right. Absolutely.
Can't run away from guys anymore.
What you're saying ties back into, again, what we were kind of already talking about and why it's important to be able to like calm your nervous system and be able to be introspective so you can find out what those things are. So you can work on those things. So you can become your best self. Because what I found is that like those, when you were talking about, I need to go work out my anger or frustration, typically those feelings are secondary emotions, not primary. But we don't really, as you were saying, we don't really dig into those primary emotions because they're scary. They're hard. Right? That we have to really hold a mirror up to ourselves in order to do that. And that's a scary place for a lot of people, including myself.
I think we're getting better as a society, and especially as a masculine society where we as men in particular, it's always been stigmatized to talk about mental health. It's always been stigmatized to show vulnerability. I mean, I still see people from older generations who think that admitting a mistake is a sign of weakness, which is insane to me.
Right.
Like they will sit there and argue something they know is not true and accurate because their ego is so fragile. And you're like, dude, like we're sitting here having a discussion that we both know is not based in actuality, but we're going to go through this pageantry just to placate your ego. I mean, when you hear it articulated, it's insane, man. But the fact that that was the norm for so long, and those of us who are in leadership positions now, those were the people that trained us. So breaking that cycle, I think is very healthy. And I think to recognize the fact that vulnerability is strength. self-awareness is strength. Mm-hmm. Having the confidence to put your cards on the table and seek genuine like improvement and being able to operate from a place of empathy is so much stronger than projecting false bravado or this like what they call it like the alpha bro kind of stuff.
Right.
Like, I mean, you look at these guys and you're like, come on, man, it's just silly. It's silly what you see, but there is still a portion of society who thinks that's strength, which is wild.
Yeah.
If you look at all high achievers, whether it be in business or in sports or anything that requires you to operate at a truly higher level, there's a common trait of introspection, self-awareness, and the constant desire to improve. I think the ceiling, your personal ceiling is so much lower if you don't embrace that reality.
I am so happy to hear you say that, Philip, and to bring that up, because I think that there needs to be more conversations about, you know, the limitations, if you will, we'll call it that, of the alpha male bro code. Well, I guess ways that we see males act, the portrayal of strength being the most important thing. And as you said, not being able to admit that you're wrong because you're protecting that fragile ego. And I think that, again, more conversations need to be had about that to let young men, as well as I guess our older generations as well, know that it's okay, that you don't have to pretend or be that alpha dominant male or personality at all times, and to be able to show your vulnerable side. As you said, that is truly strength. One of the things I want to touch on is one of your quotes, and it talks about, you know, push your limits daily. You say that we live in a culture that celebrates comfort, but real fulfillment lives on the edge of challenge. Whether it's physical, mental, or professional, it's time to get uncomfortable on purpose. And I was hoping you could kind of unpack that a little bit in terms of how that highlights growth on the edge of difficulty, if that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, and this is fundamentally what I think, and I didn't mean to speak for Ian, but what you're trying to help people understand is that you're capable of so much more than you realize,
mm-hmm.
but you'll never realize that unless you try, right? And part of that involves creating an environment where you can fail. And I, one of the things I get to do, which is a lot of fun, is I get to speak at this entrepreneurship course at my alma mater at Rochester Institute of Technology. And one of the things I say is, in order to be a successful entrepreneur, you have to have the willingness and the ability to fail. And I say that because if you don't have the willingness and the ability to fail, you are never going to push yourself to the point where you need to in order to truly succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say the ability in the professional space, it means a company needs to be funded enough that you don't have other people depending on the success of that thing in the short term, because then you're going to start making decisions that are based on not what's in the best interest of the organization or the thing or the product or whatever. But I think in our personal lives, it revolves back to what you and I were talking about surrounding yourself with people that you can truly trust, that you know are non-judgmental, that are supportive, where it's a cycle of giving and taking amongst the group based on when who needs what. So you feel safe, right? And you feel comfortable being uncomfortable so that you can challenge yourself to be emotionally vulnerable, to try to do things that you wouldn't otherwise feel comfortable because you kind of don't know what's going to happen. And that's why I say in my company, like, if you're not failing, you're not trying. I mean, you look at, I don't know why I keep using sports analogies, but it seems to be that kind of day. But like, you know, if you look at a baseball player that succeeds less than a third of every attempt, that baseball player gets to go to the Hall of Fame. Talk about somebody that's comfortable with failure. When the very best in the world at a thing fail more often than they succeed. So why is it that we expect that we have to be perfect all the time. Mm-hmm. We don't. Nobody is. And unfortunately, there are constant reminders that harp on error rather than celebrating success, right? And I think that's one thing we need to break is be like, look, let's look at the aggregate result rather than the individual input pieces. And the aggregate result is the whole, right? Like it's, yeah. I mean, can you imagine if we rated our sales teams based on the percentage with which they had success rather than their total contribution to the organization? That's insane, right? Like we would never think of doing that. But isn't that effectively what we do or what we see people do in our daily lives? Isn't that what we see when we people are so frequent to talk about negative experiences rather than positive experiences? Like the probability of somebody sharing a negative experience at a restaurant versus an exceptionally positive experience is 10x.
Right.
It's wild. It's just we're wired to focus on the negative. Well, seems silly to me. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
You either succeed or you learn, right?
Yes. I love that. Yeah. That is a great philosophy. And again, something that we need to be spreading that all over the place. Cause I truly believe that you don't fail if you learn from, and if you're paying attention, you can learn from every situation, whether it is positive or negative, but really important if you're paying attention to those negative ones. If you learn something, then you really haven't failed. Because you can take that nugget, that pearl of wisdom, and you can grow from it.
For sure. For sure.
Well, Philip, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to drop some wisdom on us. And I want to also let our listeners and our viewers know where they can find out more about you, where they can find out more about Pickle Juice, because it is a very interesting and unique product. And for those of us that are in the fitness space that are active lives at all, really use something that can cure muscle cramps in 60 seconds.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the plug. I appreciate it. Just go to picklepower.com. Anything you might want to know, well, at least you can start there and find it. All of the science behind how muscle cramping works and the physiology of muscle cramping. It's all in there. University of Stirling studies done by Thomas Cannon and all of that stuff. And anybody can contact us through there as well. And we're happy to share our story, our vision, our mission, all of it.
Wait, for someone who's going out to go find it, is it in C stores? Is it in grocery stores? Where can they find it on the shelves?
Yeah, it's in the U.S. we're in about 15,000 stores around the country, everything from your local grocer to Walmart to your sporting goods specialty store. You can go to the bottom of picklepower.com and there's a store locator. And if you can't find it there, shoot us an email or give us a call and we'll let you know where you can find it.
Awesome. All right. Well, Philip, again, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. I know our listeners and viewers can extrapolate a lot of pearls of wisdom from what we talked about in terms of the business world and the sporting world into their own personal life to really step into that next best version of themselves. So again, thank you so much for joining us. And I want to thank all of our listeners and viewers for joining us. As always, as we wrap things up, remember to stay positive, stay persistent, and know that mindset is everything. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of the Positive Persistence family. We're having a great time creating this content, and we truly hope it inspires you to embrace positivity and persistence in your own journey. If this podcast episode inspired you or entertained you, scroll down, hit those stars, and leave a comment. Your 5-star reviews and shares encourage us and help us grow the show. So until next time, stay positive, stay persistent, and remember, mindset is everything.